This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President Obama said Tuesday night that he's making the decision to send 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan because he's convinced that our security is at stake in Afghanistan and Pakistan. He described the area as the epicenter of the violent extremism practiced by al-Qaeda and the place where new attacks against us are being plotted. But what exactly is al-Qaeda now, 8 years after the 9/11 attacks? What is its connection to the Taliban? And what is the nature of the threat these groups pose to the U.S. today? That's what we're going to talk about with journalist Peter Bergen. He's CNN security analyst, co-directs the Counterterrorism Strategy Initiative at the New America Foundation, and is a research fellow at NYU's Center on Law and Security. He's written two books about bin Laden. The first was published in 2001, before the 9/11 attacks. In 1997, he produced bin Laden's first TV interview, in which bin Laden declared war against the U.S. Peter Bergen, welcome to Fresh Air. President Obama said Tuesday, "If I did not think that the security of the United States and the safety of the American people were at stake in Afghanistan, I would gladly order every single one of our troops home tomorrow." You've written that we can't defeat al-Qaeda without securing Afghanistan. Why do you say that?
Well, history indicates what happens if there is a vacuum in Afghanistan. We've seen this videotape, by the way, twice. Once in 1989 when we closed our embassy there, zeroed out aid to one of the poorest countries in the world, and basically the United States and the international community turned its back on Afghanistan. Into the vacuum in 96 rose the Taliban. And then they invited or acquiesced and then hosted al-Qaeda. And then again, after we overthrew the Taliban, because of the Bush administration's aversion to nation building, from an ideological point of view, it was the least resourced post-World War II reconstruction effort the United States has engaged in for at least the first several years. So you get what you pay for, and we've already you know, the critics of Obama's plan have to answer a very simple question, which is, what is the alternative? And one alternative would be to pull out completely. Well, we've already done that. Another alternative would be to do something kind of light and just sort of a counterterrorism mission. Well, we've already done that too. And we've seen the results. That was basically the Bush administration approach from, I would say, 2001 to about 2006, 2007, to the Bush administration's credit. So, you know, that's why I support what the president is doing. I think that it's got a fighting chance of success, and part of that also is, you know, this is just not my opinion. The Afghan population is just overwhelmingly still in favor of the international presence. The numbers have gone down, but the polling data is very, very strong. We've had nationwide polls by any number of organizations, including the BBC, ABC News, Asia Society, the International Republican Institute, a lot of different organizations. And they generally find the same thing, which is that at least half the population or more has a favorable view of the United States.
So you've warned that we've pulled out of Afghanistan before and it's been disastrous, especially because we left Afghanistan in a messy, chaotic state when we pulled out. But if President Obama is committing to starting withdrawal of troops in 2011 – and he's adding 30,000 more troops now, what are the odds that Afghanistan is going to be in such great shape that an expert like you would be comfortable pulling out then and feeling like, okay, now we've really secured the country, it's no longer liable to become a haven for al-Qaeda?
Well, you know, the 2011 pullout was, I think, largely for domestic political consumption, particularly to mollify those particularly on the liberal side of the Democratic Party who are opposed to it, and those Americans who are opposed to it. And also, it does also give more leverage over the Afghans. We're just, you know, this is not just a blank check, and you have to get your act together too. But if you look at what he actually said, he talked about conditions on the ground being part of the calculus for the drawdown in 2011. Right now, there is of the 34 provinces in Afghanistan, only one province, the province of Kabul, is capable of administering itself from a military and police point of view. The other provinces are not at that point. So, you know, in July of 2011, maybe there'll be two provinces, or maybe there'll be 10 provinces that you can turn over to Afghan control. But there's a massive caveat in what he said, and I think that the headline was, we're pulling out in 2011. But if you actually look what he said, he didn't say that at all.
Yemen and Somalia are already in some ways safe havens for jihadists. So if we secured Afghanistan, one argument is that al-Qaeda and maybe even the Taliban, at least the leadership, could get safe haven in Yemen or Somalia. So why is that a scenario that's any better or any worse than safe haven in Afghanistan?
I'm by nature somebody who's interested in history. And if you look at every major jihadist terrorist attack of the last decade and a half, whether it was the first Trade Center attack of 93, 9/11, the Cole attack in 2000, the U.S. Embassy's attacks in 98, the Bali attack in 2002, the 7/7 attack in London, which was the largest, deadliest terrorist attack in British history, all of these things have one thing in common. They were conceived of and trained for in Afghanistan or Pakistan, and since 9/11 specifically on the Afghan-Pak border. They weren't conceived of or trained for in Somalia or Yemen. I mean, I'm not happy that there is an al-Qaeda presence in Yemen. I don't think the Yemeni government is happy. But there's been no evidence from the Somali case or the Yemeni case that these groups are capable of operations anywhere other than there in the countries they operate in, or to some degree neighboring countries. So, you know, the argument that al-Qaeda could go anywhere else, of course, you know, pigs can fly and, you know, all sorts of things can happen. But the fact is that al-Qaeda, for the last two decades, it was founded in 1988 in western Pakistan. That's where it's been based. That's, you know, this is where these guys live. They've never moved anywhere else.
Well, Bin Laden moved to, was it Yemen or Somalia? I'm trying to remember.
Well, he moved to Sudan.
Sudan,
from
that's
Saudi
what it was.
Arabia.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Let me put it this way. You know, Bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, his number two, arrived in Pakistan in the mid 80s. So both of them at that time were relatively young men. Bin Laden was in his mid-20s. Ayman al-Zawahiri was probably around 30. These guys have spent more of their adult lives in Pakistan and Afghanistan than their home countries by, you know, significant factors. Ayman al-Zawahiri is married into a local tribe. I wouldn't be surprised at all if Osama bin Laden is similarly married into local tribes. You know, this is where they are. They're not – and they, you know, they've had 8 years to go to Yemen or Somalia, and they haven't done that. Similarly, all the other leaders of al-Qaeda have remained in that area.
President Obama talks about the threat from al-Qaeda and, you know, that it was al-Qaeda who attacked us in 9/11. We have to prevent them from doing more harm. So, you know, that's a good deal of his justification for increasing the number of troops in Afghanistan. You've been trying to assess what the actual threat from al-Qaeda is now. So let me start with this. What is al-Qaeda now? It's changed a lot since 9/11. What's left of it? What shape does it take?
The problem with describing al-Qaeda is that depending on your vantage point, it can look at different things at different times. So one thing that we forget in this discussion, Terry, I think sometimes, is we focus very much on al-Qaeda as being the problem, and al-Qaeda certainly is the group that attacked us. But don't forget that before 9/11, every Muslim insurgency group in the world was headquartered in Afghanistan. That's where they trained. So it wasn't just al-Qaeda that was using this as a training ground. It was a lot of other groups. Al-Qaeda itself is certainly, you know, changed. What kind of threat do they pose to the United States? It's not the organization that attacked on 9/11, which means the threat to the United States is lower than it was. But, you know, bin Laden functions. I mean, there are interesting cases in the United States where in the last year or so, there have been a whole set of cases that are absolutely fascinating to me in the United States, going from the gamut of American citizens like a guy called Najibullah Zazi, who in Denver, traveling to an al-Qaeda training camp and getting training from al-Qaeda, to, you know, groups like a group who are in North Carolina who are alleged to have cased Quantico Marine Base in Virginia, who seem to be acting in an al-Qaeda-like manner, even though they've got no connections to the al-Qaeda core group at all. Or Major Hassan, who, you know, his motivations still are a little unclear, but clearly he had some sort of jihadist intent. And, you know, so al-Qaeda is able to operate as an organization. It's able to operate as an inspiration. It has a network of like-minded groups that are plugged into it. For instance, Lashkar-e-Toiba, you know, was really only a Kashmiri militant group until relatively recently. But by attacking in Mumbai and specifically targeting Westerners and Jews, it indicates that it's taken on a more al-Qaeda-like manner. So, you know, it you know, Al-Qaeda is a sort of shorthand for a kind of larger phenomenon.
Now, although Al-Qaeda still thinks of itself as at war with the United States, you've been trying to assess the threat that Al-Qaeda poses, and you think Al-Qaeda poses a second-order threat. What do you mean by a second-order threat?
When 9/11 happened, the United States reoriented its national security policy completely. I don't think Al-Qaeda can do that again for the foreseeable future. I'm not saying that they don't have the intent to do it, but their capability is weakened now. But, you know, they could pull off something like killing hundreds of Americans overseas if they manage to bring down a commercial aircraft, as they've tried to on a number of occasions. Richard Reid, the shoe bomber, if you recall, in December of 2001, the planes plot in London in the summer of 2006. You know, that's a possibility. But I think, you know, a large-scale mass casualty attack on the United States, I don't think that's possible. What I think might be possible is something – the outer reach would be something like Oklahoma City, 168 people dead, or the lower reach would be the World Trade Center attack of 93, which was 6 people dead. Obviously, that would be a tragic event, but it wouldn't – I don't think we would completely change our national security policy because we've had a terrorist attack that killed scores of people. I mean, that's inevitably going to happen at some point, you know, whether it's a year from now or 10 years from now, I don't know. But, you know.
What do you think they are targeting?
Well, I mean, you know, Najib Bulazizi, the Afghan-American, if the allegations against him are true, he trained in an Al-Qaeda training camp. He was scoping out targets in Manhattan. Bruce Hoffman, one of the leading terrorism experts in the world, described that to me as a Mumbai on Hudson type plan if he succeeded. Certainly, it seemed that he was going to, you know, plant one or more bombs.
This is the guy who was trying to make bombs by buying peroxide hair dye at cosmetic stores.
Right. And in fact, hydrogen peroxide bombs is a signature of Al-Qaeda right now. And the reason that I think I can say with some certainty that if he'd succeeded, if the allegations are true, he would have killed scores of people because that's exactly the same ingredient that was used in the 7/7 attack in London, July 7, 2005, which killed 52 commuters. The process of making hydrogen peroxide bomb is pretty complex. It's not something you can learn on the internet. It's a very unstable bomb material. But the reason that terrorists like to use it is that if you buy nitroglycerine or ammonium nitrate or these kind of traditional explosives, you're going to draw a lot of attention to yourself. If you're just buying hydrogen peroxide, you're going to draw less attention to yourself. So Najib Bulazizi was building one of these bombs. And we've seen this also, by the way, in the Ramstein Air Force Base was a target of two Germans and a Turk in 2007. They also had learned how to make hydrogen peroxide bombs. And if the planes plot of the summer of 2006 had been carried off, again, those guys were experimenting with hydrogen peroxide bombs. So this is sort of a signature of Al-Qaeda right now.
So you think Al-Qaeda is targeting the United States with hydrogen peroxide bombs that would be aimed at what kind of targets?
I think any target they can. You know, at this point, they need to show the flag. But they would continue to be interested in cities like Manhattan, symbolic targets. Los Angeles International Airport has been a target of an Al-Qaeda affiliate in the past. So, you know, they're not interested in attacking Des Moines because the people that they're trying to influence don't know where Des Moines is. I mean, they're trying to show to their followers that they're still capable of attacking the United States. So they want to do that in places like Washington and New York. They have no interest in doing it in sort of small cities that don't have any kind of valence for their followers.
Now, you've written that Al-Qaeda has made common cause with the Taliban and that at the leadership level, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban function more or less as a single entity. Would you explain what you think the connection now is between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban?
Yeah. When the Taliban were in power before 9/11, this was a very provincial group of people. I actually spent time under the Taliban-controlled Afghanistan, which is one of the many reasons I'm somewhat optimistic about what's happening in Afghanistan because, you know, the country was so poor at the time that the World Bank stopped measuring its GDP. There was no business. It was there was a, you know, the Taliban were a provincial group of people, not very competent. As time went on, they got more and more infected by the Al-Qaeda worldview. I'm sure you remember the Taliban blowing up the Buddhas of Bamiyan, which have been standing in the Bamiyan Valley since respectively the 3rd and 5th centuries. And those Buddhas of Bamiyan, the blowing that up was a sort of an Al-Qaeda idea, essentially. It's the Taliban became more and more militant as time went on. They forced, for instance, Hindus to wear yellow, distinctive yellow clothing in the run-up to 9/11. And they were becoming more and more militant, and Al-Qaeda was influencing them. And that process, I think, has actually accelerated since 9/11.
Now, one distinction I often hear between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban is that Al-Qaeda is into world jihad, global jihad,
yeah,
whereas the Taliban are interested in gaining power in their region, not that interested in the West, the United States. Do you think that distinction still applies?
I think that's generally true. But I think it's sort of a distinction that doesn't really mean a great deal, because if the implication of that is, well, if the Taliban came back to power, we wouldn't need to worry, I think that's ridiculous, because if the Taliban came back to power, they would bring Al-Qaeda back with them. I mean, they've shown that that's their modus operandi, both before 9/11 and since 9/11. They've been sheltering the Taliban. They've been sheltering Al-Qaeda since 9/11, and they were sheltering Al-Qaeda before 9/11. And they haven't. Mullah Omar has had multiple opportunities to say, you know, I think Osama bin Laden's a bad idea, or Al-Qaeda are a bad group. You know, he hasn't done any of that. So, I mean, if the Taliban took power even in parts of Afghanistan, it would help Al-Qaeda. The Taliban project has been partly about protecting Al-Qaeda. It's also about trying to gain power in Afghanistan. But these two things are related.
You know, one of the many issues that's been raised about the Taliban is, can we negotiate with them? Can we negotiate with the leadership of the Taliban? If not, can we negotiate and offer opportunities to more lower-level people in the Taliban, offer them jobs, pay them, just give them an incentive to leave the Taliban and join, our side or the government side? If
yeah,
there were a government that wasn't corrupt. Anyways, I wonder, like, do you think that either on the high level or low level of the Taliban that there can be people who can be negotiated with or changed?
Well, there can always be people who can be bribed or coerced or into doing things. And but on the upper levels of the Taliban, I'm pretty suspicious for several reasons about the idea that we're going to be able to do a deal with them, we being the Afghan government, really, with our support. One is we've already seen what the Pakistani Taliban did when they did peace deals with the Pakistani government, which is essentially they used them as interim arrangements to extend their reach into other parts of Pakistan. So they didn't observe these peace deals. Secondly, Mullah Omar has taken every opportunity to say he's not interested in any negotiations unless international forces pull out. Well, if international forces pull out, the Taliban would roll into Kabul tomorrow. So that's a non-starter. Thirdly, I think the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are closer together ideologically and tactically. That makes it harder to negotiate with them on the leadership level. And fourthly, the Taliban right now don't think they're losing and maybe think they're even winning. And so why would they negotiate for a piece of pie now that they can get a larger piece of pie later? And so that's one of the reasons that President Obama is accelerating this 30,000 troop deployment to blunt their momentum so that they don't feel that they're in some way winning. So I'm pretty skeptical on the lower levels of the Taliban negotiations. I think that's, it's very doable. In fact, something that's not well understood is that thousands of Taliban foot soldiers have already taken advantage of an amnesty program that's been in place for several years now. And it's been pretty successful. The recidivism rate has been very low. So, I think it's possible. In any insurgency, you can always get people who are foot soldiers to defect for one reason or another. And obviously, as you pointed out, Terry, I mean, I think that a very powerful incentive is just jobs. And in fact, Senator Carl Levin, the chairman of the Senate Arms Services Committee, has put a pretty big chunk of change in a defense appropriations bill precisely for that purpose, which is for American commanders basically to put people to put people on the Taliban payroll on our payroll, which of course was one of the reasons that the Iraq war turned around. The real the biggest surge in Iraq was not obviously the American surge of 30,000 is important, but a really big surge was having the 100,000 man sons of Iraq. These were 100,000 people who used to be shooting at Americans who were suddenly put on our payroll and then started shooting at our enemies. So that's a 200,000 man surge if you think about it, because it's 100,000 enemies who are suddenly becoming on your side and actually working for you.
One of the geniuses of the Taliban seems to be that if they feel they're going to be defeated in any one area, they retreat. They go someplace else and they set up shop someplace else. So you can declare victory in the area where the Taliban have fled, but it's not really a victory if they're just moving to someplace else and setting up
there was
shop
a book,
there.
There's a book, Terry, from which I actually haven't read, but it has a great title. It was written in 1961 by, I think, a guy called David Tabor, and it's called The War of the Flea. And it was about counterinsurgencies. And basically, you know, for any, you know, that's what insurgents do. I mean, they're the flea. They move. They you know, it's very hard to trap them in a place and defeat them. And that's why it's so important to get the population on your side to basically help you with trying to defeat the insurgency, because there's no way you can do it conventionally.
And the Taliban are also very patient. So, you know, one argument against the Obama strategy is that if you, pledge to strengthen things for a while, knowing that you're going to start pulling out as soon as you can, preferably in 2011, President Obama says, then why can't the Taliban flee where they're under fire, wait patiently until we leave, and then, you know, take over the country? We wouldn't avoid the worst-case scenario that we're trying to avoid.
Well, the one factor that's missing from that is building up the Afghan army and police. Now, right now, they don't the Afghan army, by the way, is the most popular institution in the country, and it's seen as being a sort of mostly fair player. The police are very corrupt and are not well regarded. But that was also true, by the way, in Iraq, and that changed. Now, you know, absolutely. If it's just the Taliban will just wait and, you know, until we leave, then, you know, raises the question of why are we there. But if the strategy, our exit strategy from the United States, exit strategy from Afghanistan is clearly building up a somewhat functional Afghan army. It doesn't have to be a particularly great army. It just needs to be good enough to deal with the Taliban. And, you know, right now, there's a certain paradox, which is that the Afghans are some of the world's greatest fighters, and right now they have one of the world's worst armies. And I think that's perhaps because we're sort of forcing them into a kind of a Western model of what an army should look like, rather than just letting them kind of fight in a more, you know, sort of special forces, small unit kind of formations that they naturally militia. Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, that's how they defeated the Soviets. I mean, so I think there is a way of you know, that is the only exit strategy possible. We're not, you know, otherwise, if you've raised a very good point. I mean, if it's all about the Taliban waiting us out, then we have to be there forever. We're obviously not going to be there forever. And I do think that, you know, there are. Building up the Afghan army is not a complete pipe dream, but it's certainly not something that's going to happen by July of 2011.
Now, you've written that the Saudis have been facilitating backdoor negotiations between the Afghan government and more moderate elements of the Taliban. What can you tell us about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, this has been fairly widely reported that in Mecca in the fall of last year, some fairly senior figures in the Afghan government met with fairly formerly senior Taliban officials who are more on the moderate side. And these include the former foreign minister, the former ambassador of the United Nations. These are guys, by the way, who were never fans of Osama bin Laden, always regard him as being bad for business. The problem with the negotiations is that the people who are really involved in the insurgency didn't really send anybody. The major figures in the insurgency, the Mullah Omars, the Haqqani network, they're not part of this process. But, you know, at least it's something. And the Saudis could play an even bigger role, an even more useful role, both in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. Saudi Arabia was one of the three governments in the world that recognized the Taliban. This is a group of, people who really believe that they're doing God's work. And, of course, the Saudis come with a great deal of credibility because they're the keepers of the two holy places. And so, you know, I mean, I hope this process continues. But right now it's not really yielding anything. But you know, these insurgencies go on for a long time, and baby steps is just because they're baby steps, it doesn't mean that it might not yield something down the road. I think everybody knows that the Taliban is going to have to be part of the future of Afghanistan in some shape or form. Taliban is sort of a loaded word, but, you know, rural Pashtuns need to feel kind of that they're part of the Afghanistan's future and that their interests are represented. And part of the problem here is that there aren't really Pashtun political parties of any great size. So you're sort of – if you're a Pashtun, you've got Hamid Karzai on one side who's a Pashtun, and you've got the Taliban with little in between. And hopefully in the next 5 years under a Karzai government, there will be more Pashtun political participation in parties. That would begin to help this process move along.
What do you think would be the most effective way of stopping al-Qaeda? I mean, one is to get, as I said, get bin Laden and his number two. Short of that?
Well, something we have very little control over and should try and exercise no control over anyway, which is Muslim public opinion, has moved very dramatically against al-Qaeda. You know, bin Laden and the Taliban had this sort of Robin Hood flavor in Pakistan for a long time. But now the Pakistani public, in a recent poll, 90% of them said that religious extremism was a very serious problem in their country. Support for bin Laden is waning. The Taliban is waning. Support for suicide bombing in Pakistan, where these groups are largely headquartered, has dropped from 33% to 5% in the last several years. And that's a story that we've seen in Jordan, where, do you remember, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi launched an attack on three hotels in Amman, Jordan, which killed mostly Jordanians attending a wedding, which if you were to design an operation more suited to destroying your credibility, it's hard to think of one. Same process happened in Iraq. It's happened in Indonesia. It's happened in Saudi Arabia. These groups, embedded in their DNA, are the seeds of their own destruction, because they've decided that they are the world's only true Muslims, and that if they kill other Muslims, that it's not a problem. And in Muslim country after Muslim country, it is a problem for the 99% of the population that is opposed to the, that is on the receiving end of this. And so they're losing the war of ideas. First of all, and the general population, and then very importantly, they're also losing the war ideas even amongst militants and jihadists. People who fought with them in Afghanistan have turned against them. Militant clerics like there's a guy called Salman al-Auda in Saudi Arabia who I've met, who by bin Laden's own account was the reason that he started attacking the United States. Salman al-Auda was a Saudi cleric who issued the first fatwas against the American military presence as a result of Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm. He was imprisoned by the Saudis for 7 years. And bin Laden has said that he's a sort of an inspiration to him. Now, this guy has gone out on Middle East Broadcasting Corporation, one of the biggest TV networks in the Middle East, and in other venues, and has publicly criticized not just 9/11, not just terrorism, but bin Laden by name. Because we've had a lot of Muslim clerics who've said that 9/11 was wrong or terrorism is bad. But very few have actually had the courage to say that actually bin Laden is immoral. And this is what this guy did 5 or 6 years after 9/11. So that kind of support is evaporating. Now, the counterargument, if Bruce Hoffman was here, the leading scholar of terrorism in the United States, he would point out that in the 70s, the Brigati Rossi in Italy and the Baader-Meinhof gang in Germany, practically brought these societies to their knees, and they had zero public support. So yeah, terrorist groups can survive with very little public support. But it certainly doesn't help them if their public support is really evaporating.
You've written that you think the threat from al-Qaeda and its jihadist affiliates is greater in Europe than it is in the United States, and it's especially great in the UK. How come?
I think part of that is an accident of geography and history. 70% of the British Muslim population comes from Pakistan. Pakistan is where al-Qaeda and the Taliban are headquartered. If you have jihadist ideas, you can get training pretty easily in Pakistan. 400,000 British citizens go to Pakistan every year, 99.9% of them for completely legitimate vacations. But a tiny minority end up with a Kashmiri militant group, which is often a way station to meet up with al-Qaeda. And they get training. And we've seen the deadliest terrorist attack in British history was directed by al-Qaeda. Two of the leaders trained with al-Qaeda in the tribal regions in Pakistan, the 7/7 attacks. And there are a number of other British terrorist plots, all of which lead back to the tribal regions of Pakistan.
So it's not so much that al-Qaeda is more interested in attacking the UK than in the United States. It's rather that it's easier to do it because of people who are already living in England who might go back to their home country and get training.
Right. And in fact, you know, when we've al-Qaeda is kind of conscious of this. So, for instance, when they try to blow up an American Airlines flight between Miami and Paris, it was a British citizen who had the shoe bomb in his sneakers. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you can kind of attack the United States offshore is, I think, the way al-Qaeda sees it. And another example is the planes plot of the summer of 2006, where an al-Qaeda directed cell using hydrogen peroxide bombs plan to bring down seven American Canadian airliners leaving Heathrow. By the way, this was right around the fifth anniversary of 9/11. This was al-Qaeda's way of celebrating in a ghoulish way the fifth anniversary of 9/11. But, you know, what's interesting about their plot is two things. First of all, they targeted commercial aviation, which is the hardest target imaginable right now. So they remain obsessed by this. The second thing is that they did it in the United Kingdom because they don't have, you know, 12 people or 20 people as this plot needed that they can recruit here in the United States. They might be able to recruit one or two people, but they can't recruit, you know, a couple of dozen, which would, you know, for a major terrorist plot where you're going to have multiple targets or multiple suicide bombers, you need more than obviously just one person.
At the same time, you've written about the growing threat from homegrown terrorists in the United States, people who have been trained by al-Qaeda. And examples of that you give are Najibul Azazi, the Afghan-American man who bought hydrogen peroxide from beauty shops in order to make bombs. But he was arrested before he progressed too far with that plan. Would you consider Major Hassan, the Palestinian-American officer who massacred people at Fort Hood recently, would you consider him an example of that, of a homegrown terrorist?
Well, I mean, it was certainly an act of terror, and I think it was motivated by jihadist ideas. I mean, I say that having thought about it pretty carefully because I didn't, you know, no one wants to leap to conclusions. But if you look at his actions in the days leading up to his death, let me just go through them because I think it's important. First of all, he gave away all his possessions to his neighbors. Secondly, he said that he was going to go and do God's work. When he talked to one of his neighbors, he gave them his Qurans, you know, a very important possession for a devout Muslim. The day of the operation, he dressed in white. You may remember there was a convenience store videotape of him. White, by the way, is traditionally associated with martyrdom in Islam. He was exploring suicide bombing, the question of killing of innocents. His communications with a radical cleric in Yemen had accelerated during this period. He seemed like he was going out to do a sort of jihadist death by cop. I mean, I think he intended to die, and it's a surprise that he's ended up in a, you know, paralyzed in a San Antonio, Texas hospital.
How well do you think the FBI is doing in stopping homegrown terrorists from carrying out their attacks?
I think, generally speaking, very well. I mean, a huge amount of resources has gone into the FBI and other arms of the American government since 9/11. I think there are something like 2,000 FBI agents who are involved in counterterrorism cases. Before 9/11, it would have been, you know, orders of magnitude smaller. And you have joint terrorism task forces around the country. I mean, you know, I think that, you know, some of this is more in the area of overkill rather than underkill. But, of course, you know, somebody's always going to get through. And Major Hassan was – the FBI was aware of some of his internet postings, and they kind of dismissed it as not being a problem. The FBI was also cognizant of a guy called Abdul Hakim Mujahid Muhammad, who was an African-American convert to Islam who traveled to Yemen early this year and then came back and then shot up a military recruiting station in Little Rock, Arkansas over the summer and killed an American soldier. So the FBI seems to have really dropped the ball in his case. But as a general proposition, I think that the criticism is more about people, you know, FBI or other elements of the government sort of entrapping people into, you know, the classic example of this is the Liberty City case, where six mostly Haitian immigrants believe they were swearing an oath of allegiance to al-Qaeda, but in fact it was a government informant. And they were planning to blow up the Sears Tower in Chicago, although they never traveled to Chicago. They never had guns. They never had weapons. The case went to trial three times. It took only on the third time would were their convictions in that case. So, you know, I think the FBI and other agencies have done a pretty good job. And if there is criticism, sometimes it's more about overkill rather than underkill.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Bergen. He's CNN's national security analyst. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation and a research fellow at NYU's Center on Law and Security. His latest book is called The Osama Bin Laden I Know, An Oral History of Al-Qaeda's Leader. I'm interested in hearing what you think of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee report that was recently released criticizing the American military and basically criticizing General Tommy Franks, who was running the war in Afghanistan, and then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld for not sending reinforcements to Tora Bora when the military was telling them, Bin Laden's here and we could get him, but we need reinforcements.
I mean, I think it's entirely accurate. And in fact, they interviewed me for the report, and I've been to Tora Bora and I've spoken to a lot of people on all sides of the battle, and the evidence for Bin Laden being there is simply overwhelming. And that was known to people in the U.S. government at pretty high levels, if you go back and look at what they said at the time. And, you know, they dropped the ball. There's just no, you know, by my calculation, there were more American journalists at Tora Bora than there were American soldiers, certainly more Western journalists. And if CNN can get its crew to Tora Bora, why can't this 82nd Airborne get there?
So what are the consequences that are being played out as a result?
Well, you know, I think if you'd captured or killed, it wasn't just Bin Laden at the Battle of Tora Bora. It was, you know, the entire top leadership, and they more or less all of them escaped. You know, I think the group would have – you would have really put a dampener on the group. You know, they wouldn't come back. I mean, if you think about what they've done since 9/11, they conducted the deadliest terrorist attack in British history. They helped plunge Iraq into a civil war because it was al-Qaeda who was doing the vast majority of all the suicide attacks. They have influenced the Taliban ideologically and tactically with all the results that we know in Afghanistan and Pakistan. I mean, they've done, you know, by not putting them out of business there, I think it's been a big problem. And, of course, it's not a coincidence that the Tora Bora Senate report was released a day before Obama's speech, I don't think.
To help justify him sending
well, it kind of sets up, you know, that there, it sets up the narrative about what happened, which is we're still in Afghanistan 8 years later because we didn't really finish the job.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's considered the principal architect of 9/11, is going to be brought to trial in New York at a federal courthouse.
Long overdue.
What are you going to be looking for?
I mean, you know, this is a cliche, but I'm looking for justice. I mean, we've already done this before many times. When the embassies got blew up in 98, you know, 200 people killed plus, mostly Africans, many of them Muslim, by the way. When the four guys involved in that were put on trial in Manhattan, no classified information came out. Any classified information was, you know, held in camera. These guys, the victims, many of the families of the victims got a chance to go to court and see these guys in court. We found out for the first time that al-Qaeda had a weapons of mass destruction program. And there's a lot of public goods in trials. And we've had, you know, we have, the United States is perfectly capable of putting someone like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed on trial. And we should have done this 5 years ago. One other point, those guys in the embassy attacks got life without parole. You know, they are going to molder away in a supermax prison in Florence, Colorado, which is about a million times worse than being in Guantanamo.
And you think the same will happen with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed?
Well, he'll either be executed, which I guess is kind of what he wants because he's got a sort of James Bond of jihad complex, or he will be, you know, it'll be life without parole, which I think Florence, Colorado is it's as close to hell on earth as you probably can get.
Peter Bergen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Peter Bergen is CNN's national security analyst and co-director of the Counterterrorism Strategy Initiative at the New America Foundation. His latest book is called The Osama Bin Laden I Know. Australian actors and filmmakers are now so much a part of the American movie scene that it's easy to forget that it wasn't until the late 1970s that the world even noticed that they made serious movies in Australia. One of the first films to grab international attention was Gillian Armstrong's My Brilliant Career, which made stars of its lead actors, Judy Davis and Sam Neill. The movie is just out on a new Blu-ray disc from Blue Underground, which has also released the film on DVD. Our critic at large, John Power, says that we can still feel its influence today.
A few months ago, I was watching a very entertaining documentary called Not Quite Hollywood, a rollicking look at the Australian exploitation movies of the 70s and early 80s. Although it was bursting with affection for gleefully bawdy and violent pictures, it got me thinking about the first non-exploitation Aussie movie I remember seeing, Gillian Armstrong's My Brilliant Career. Turns out, this is the 30th anniversary of that film's release. And after watching the gorgeous new version on Blu-ray, I can confidently say that this tale of a young woman's self-creation seems even better now than it did in 1979, not least because our current movies have virtually no interest in women. My Brilliant Career is based on a 1901 novel by a teenage girl who wrote under the name of Miles Franklin. The time is the late 19th century, the place rural New South Wales, and the heroine Sybilla Melvin, a willfully, conflictedly headstrong young woman thrillingly played by Judy Davis. A born romantic, Sybilla dreams of being a writer, but everything is against it. Her family's poverty, her need to work as a servant, provincial society's hostility to her seemingly unwomanly ways. Then she meets a wealthy landowner named Harry Beecham. That's a young Sam Neill, who's never been so wolfishly charming. The two fall in love, but nothing is ever simple with Sybilla, and even as she leads Harry on, she also fends him off, actually slapping him with a riding crop the night he proposes marriage. Here Sybilla and Harry are talking the next day, and she tries to explain herself.
Could you? Can you give me a bit of time? Maybe 2 years. You see, I'm just not ready yet. Last night, I don't know, I think I was trying to hurt you. Make you let go. Do something. Give me a chance to find out what's wrong with the world and with me. Who I am. Everything. Then I'll marry you. If you need me, and I can help. You do understand, don't you?
When My Brilliant Career first came out in the U.S., it deservedly became a hit. Still, many critics wrote it off as merely another of the feminist fantasies common in the 1970s. It is that, but it's also something more. You see, most of the women's empowerment films of that era centered on women who were dumping a creep of a husband, sometimes swapping that creep for a sensitive artist. Here it's Sybilla who wants to be the artist, and what makes it tricky is that she loves a good guy who loves her precisely for her imagination and independence. The question is, can she have this love and achieve the brilliant writing career that she sees as her true destiny? As it happens, My Brilliant Career was itself destined to become a cultural watershed, one whose effects we can feel when we go to the movies or turn on our TVs. In fact, 30 years on, we're currently living in an era that will be remembered for being dominated by great Australian actresses. There are the ubiquitous stars like Kate Blanchett, Nicole Kidman, and Naomi Watts, who gave this decade's most brilliant performance in Mulholland Drive. There are the superb character actors like Toni Collette and Rachel Griffiths. And then there are the terrific up-and-comers like Mia Wasikowska, who stole the first season of In Treatment, and Abbie Cornish from the recent Bright Star. Now, I know there are strong American actresses, too. I'm well aware that Meryl Streep is a prodigy and that Sandra Bullock and Kate Hudson keep churning out hits. Still, it's modern Hollywood's shameful failing that it trains homegrown actresses to be likable. You know, not bitchy. Of course, that usually means being bland, girlish, uncomplicated, and totally unthreatening. That's why, when American filmmakers have a nice, complex role, they tend to cast an Aussie actress. And who can blame them? Australian actresses are less prepackaged. They're smart, tough, moody, and not cookie-cutter beautiful. Their good looks are born of intelligence and style. Better still, even their biggest stars are utterly fearless. They let themselves look plain, they don't demand star vehicles, and they're willing to play characters the audience actively dislikes. No doubt there are profound cultural reasons for all this, but there's also one straightforward explanation. Whenever I ask Aussie actresses who's inspired them, they always say the same thing, Judy Davis. It was Davis whose bravery, incandescence, and occasional cussedness set the template for what it means to be an Australian screen actress. She's the lodestar, the yardstick, and to this day, one of the world's great talents. In fact, if you want to know why this is the golden age of Australian actresses, you should start by watching Judy Davis play Sybilla Melvin. She's the godmother of all those brilliant careers.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and writes the Absolute Powers column for Vogue.com.